and welcome to Crime Monthly Presents Evil Uncovered, where we delve into real-life stories that send shivers down your spine. This week, we examine the ultimate act of betrayal with three tragic cases where once strong family bonds turned fatal. Listener discretion is advised. In November 2000, an ordinary dinner party in Tacoma, Washington, became the setting for a fateful encounter. 19-year-old Susan Cox, a bright and hopeful young woman who worked at a jewelry store, met 24-year-old Josh Powell. The chemistry between them was immediate and they began dating. It was a whirlwind romance, and just after Christmas, Josh asked Susan to use her employee discount to buy a ring he claimed was for his mother. In reality, it was for Susan. Josh proposed less than 8 weeks into their relationship. Susan was swept away, but her parents, Chuck and Judy Cox, were worried the relationship was moving at breakneck speed. Susan's friends also had concerns, as they saw Josh as lazy and unworthy of Susan. As one said,
"We thought it was all happening too fast and that she deserved better."
However, there was one person who was happy about the union, and that was Josh's sister Jennifer. She said,
"I hoped Susan would be the making of him. He needed someone like her."
Jennifer believed Susan would be good for her brother, who had endured a deeply dysfunctional upbringing in a volatile household. Their parents' acrimonious divorce had left deep scars on Josh and his siblings. Their father, Stephen, had tried to turn them against their mother, and he'd also shared pornography with his sons, leaving Josh's boundaries severely warped. He once threatened his mother with a knife and killed his sister's pets in fits of rage. In the many audio diaries he recorded, Josh revealed that Susan had been hesitant to rush into marriage, but he persuaded her, and in April 2001, they tied the knot. The couple appeared happy, but dark clouds loomed on the horizon. By 2002, financial constraints had forced the newlyweds to move in with Josh's father, Stephen. Privacy was scarce, and an unsettling atmosphere pervaded the household as a strange obsession began to surface. Stephen started filming home videos that mainly centered on his attractive daughter-in-law, who was 31 years his junior, and Susan once thought she saw a mirror slide under the door while she was using the bathroom. Before long, Stephen was writing songs professing his love for Susan, but she rebuffed his advances, telling him,
"I'm married to your son, and I should just be your daughter-in-law."
When Susan confided in Josh about Stephen's behavior, Stephen managed to convince his son that Susan had led him on. Still, the tension became unbearable, and within months, the couple relocated from Washington to Utah, hoping for a fresh start. But the move was only a temporary reprieve from the darkness that lay ahead. The seeds of a tragic future had already been sown. In 2005, the couple welcomed their first son, Charlie, followed by son Braden in 2007. But by 2008, the marriage was struggling. Josh was controlling, particularly with money. He'd demand that Susan buy the cheapest food she could find, and he'd make her skimp on feeding the children. Susan began funneling money into a separate account, telling one of her friends,
"Basically, I'm a single mother with this guy who lives with me and spends my money while dictating to me what I can do in my spare time."
The pair argued regularly, and Susan confided to her friends that Josh often threatened to hit her. Her parents grew so worried, they urged her to leave, and while Susan did eventually contact a divorce lawyer, she was worried Josh would stop her seeing the boys, or worse. Josh had persuaded her to take out life insurance worth $1 million before getting rid of the family car and forcing Susan to cycle to work every day along a busy highway. He also got her to sign control of her financial affairs over to him, giving him the authority to buy and sell investments in her name. She told friends she felt like an asset to Josh, saying,
"You tell me how easy it would be for me to have an accident. If something ever happens to me, make sure they look at Josh."
In June 2008, Susan made out a will. In it, she wrote,
"I bike to work daily and have been having extreme marital stress. If I die, it may not be an accident, even if it looks like one."
She then said that she loved her boys and would never voluntarily leave them before sealing the will. On the front page, she wrote a note that said,
"For family and friends of Susan, except for my husband Josh, I don't trust him."
Despite her misery, Susan desperately wanted another baby. In the hope that Josh's behavior would change, she set a deadline of April 2010, their 9th wedding anniversary, to either be pregnant or to leave. 5 months before that, Josh bought a gas torch capable of cutting through steel, a steam cleaner, and a 50-foot roll of plastic wrap. The stage was set for a series of events that would shock everyone who knew the Powell family. On December 6, 2009, Susan's friend Jovanna Owings visited Susan at home. The two spent the afternoon together chatting while Josh prepared pancakes and eggs. It was an unusually attentive gesture from Josh, who even brought Susan a blanket when she felt cold. At around 4:30, Susan said she was tired and went to rest. Jovanna left shortly after, marking the last time any of Susan's friends would see her. Overnight, an alarm sounded inside the garage, but the house remained dark. At around 12:30 a.m., the family minivan left the garage. The following day, when the boys didn't arrive at their daycare centre, owner Debbie Caldwell, a friend of Susan's who knew about her rocky marriage, called Josh's sister Jennifer, who contacted the police. Officers broke into the Powell home through a window and found a strange scene. A steam cleaner stood in the middle of the master bedroom, and two large fans were aimed at wet spots on the carpet and sofa. Immediately, Jennifer was hit with an overwhelming feeling something terrible had happened there. When Josh returned home with the boys that afternoon, he claimed they'd gone on a camping trip to the desert in the night, despite the fact there had been a snowstorm. He said he had no idea where Susan was, but he quickly became a person of interest in her disappearance. During one police interview, Josh described their marriage, saying,
"It's pretty good. We sometimes have disagreements, but it's not like we get into screaming fights or anything. Although it's happened a couple of times, it's very rare."
But the police knew this wasn't true. Susan's friends and family had already told them the real story. Investigators searched Josh's van, finding Susan's phone along with a tarpaulin, a spade, and power tools. They didn't have enough evidence to prove Josh was responsible for Susan's disappearance, but what they did have were deep suspicions of foul play, and these only got worse when Charlie started to speak. He told one officer,
"Mummy came camping with us, but she stayed in the place with the shiny rocks and pretty flowers."
Detectives took this to mean Susan had been with Josh and the boys, either already dead or injured and soon to die, and been buried out in the wild somewhere. But Josh still denied any wrongdoing, and without evidence, they couldn't arrest him. Within 10 days of Susan's disappearance, he'd cancelled all her upcoming appointments, removed the children from daycare, and withdrawn all the money from Susan's retirement account. Then, barely a month after his wife went missing, Josh packed up his belongings and took his two young sons back to his father's house. This relocation would mark the beginning of an even darker chapter in an already tragic story. At Stephen's house, Josh began creating a website, but this wasn't a site dedicated to finding his missing wife. Instead, it was a platform designed to paint himself as a grieving husband while casting aspersions on Susan's character. He claimed to be hoping his wife would return, but barely anyone believed him. His only real supporter was his father, but even he suspected his son had done something dreadful. Josh had told Stephen the same story he'd told the police, that he'd taken the boys on a late-night camping trip. But Stephen wrote in his diary,
"I am feeling sick. It is possible that Susan is dead. Josh's story is so implausible, I fear the worst. The whole thing sounds so wrong. In the last 2 weeks, Josh bought a welder and a carpet cleaner. I had no clue why he might want a welder, but now I wonder if it was required for the process of mutilating or disintegrating Susan's body. I doubt Susan is alive, and I doubt Josh's hands are clean. If I had only known. If I could only turn back time."
In September 2011, Josh threatened to release Susan's teenage diaries on his website, and when her family went to court to ensure that didn't happen, police raided Stephen's home to retrieve them. But while searching for the diaries, they would uncover a twisted and disturbing obsession.
During our search of the property, we came to realize that Stephen Powell had been secretly recording women and girls for a number of years. We found thousands of images, some taken through windows of females dressing and undressing, all taken without their knowledge. And there, among them, were images of his daughter-in-law, Susan Powell.
On September the 22nd, 2011, Stephen Powell was charged with multiple counts of voyeurism. A year later, the Pierce County Sheriff's Department released more than 2,000 pages from his diaries. Those same notebooks in which he detailed his fears over what his son might have done to Susan now detailed his own obsession, describing how Stephen would pleasure himself to his secret recordings of his daughter-in-law. It was later revealed that the police had found bags in Stephen's home containing toenail clippings, feminine hygiene products and underwear, all dated and labelled with Susan's name. He had a twisted fixation with his son's wife, and Susan had been as unsafe in his presence as she had been in his son's. With Stephen charged and a question mark over whether or not Josh had participated in his crimes, Charlie and Braden were removed from their father's care and placed with Susan's parents. Josh was allowed to see the boys, but police had found depictions of incestuous sex on his computer, and the court ordered him to undergo an evaluation to judge if he was at risk of committing sexual offences. Until then, the 2 3-hour visitations he was granted each week had to be supervised. Disturbingly, the boys did display troubling sexual signs while living with their grandparents, and an evaluation report said,
"They wanted to sleep naked, claiming it was normal with their father. Braden even had a fungal infection, typically contracted through sexual contact."
During the year they lived with their grandparents, the children also began to talk about Mommy being in the trunk when they went camping, and how Mom and Dad got out of the car and Mom disappeared. Chillingly, Josh had once joked that if he was going to commit murder, he'd hide the body by dropping it into an abandoned mine. Utah's West Desert, which was near their home, was littered with abandoned mines, but extensive searches found no sign of her. The shadow of Susan's disappearance loomed large, and as the search for answers continued, Josh may have started to get concerned. Though the children were not yet old enough to explain what they'd seen that fateful day, was it only a matter of time before they could? It seems Josh thought so, because he was about to commit an act so horrific, it would forever end any hope of uncovering the truth about his missing wife. On February the 5th, 2012, a social worker escorted the boys to Josh's front door for their supervised visit. The boys ran ahead, eager to see their father, but as soon as they entered, Josh slammed the door, locking the social worker out. Panic set in as she realized something was terribly wrong. She would later say,
"I heard Braden crying and Josh saying he had a surprise for Charlie. Then I smelled gasoline."
She frantically called 911, but the dispatcher failed to grasp the urgency of the situation and told her that while a patrol car would be sent, it would have to deal with life-threatening situations first. Time was slipping away, and as the social worker spoke to her supervisor on the phone, she heard the ominous strike of a match. The explosion that followed was so powerful it shook the neighboring houses, and by the time emergency services arrived, it was too late. Josh and his sons were dead. However, there was still worse to come. When the post-mortem examinations were done, they revealed that 7-year-old Charlie and 5-year-old Braden had been attacked with a hatchet before the fire was set. The primary causes of death turned out to be chopping injuries, with carbon monoxide poisoning a secondary cause. The boys could have suffered for up to 10 agonizing minutes before succumbing to their injuries. Before committing this final act of violence, Josh left instructions on how to handle his bills and, in a voicemail to loved ones, he said,
"I am not able to live without my sons, and I'm not able to go on anymore. I'm sorry to everyone I've hurt. Goodbye."
This horrific act not only ended the lives of 2 innocent boys, but also extinguished any remaining hope of discovering what happened to Susan. And despite extensive searches, her body has never been found. The mystery of her disappearance continues to haunt those who knew her, and the unanswered questions only add to the tragedy. As one police officer said,
"We have always believed Josh was responsible for Susan's disappearance. But without a body, without concrete evidence, our hands were tied.
In 2017, Stephen Powell was released from prison after serving a 30-month sentence. A year later, he died from heart problems, taking with him any secrets he might have held about Susan's fate. And so the tragic case remains unresolved, and Susan's final resting place a secret that Josh took to his grave. The search may never end, but the hope for answers remains. The community, her family, and the investigators continue to seek the truth, even as the years pass by.
We just want to know what happened to her. We want closure. We want to bring her home.
As we leave the devastating case of Susan Powell and her children, our second story sees us traveling across Utah to the small town of American Fork, and a tragic tale of faith, fanaticism, and a horrific act of violence that shattered an entire community. On July the 24th, 1984, Alan Lafferty took a brief break from his job as a tile setter to phone his wife, Brenda. Their conversation was a short one, just long enough for him to hear the sweet gurgles of their baby daughter, Erica, before he went back to work with a smile. He couldn't have known this would be the last time he'd hear either of their voices, or that soon after that call, their lives would be cut short in a brutal double slaying. But who would do such a monstrous thing? Alan knew exactly who was responsible, and it would turn out to be the most savage act of betrayal imaginable. Deeply rooted in the mainstream Mormon church, the Lafferty family was a large and traditional one. With six brothers and two sisters, the Laffertys upheld the values of their faith, opposing premarital sex, gambling, and alcohol. The family dynamics were complex, with each sibling carving out their own path within the framework of their shared beliefs. Among the siblings, Alan stood out for his gentle nature and strong adherence to the church's teachings. His life took a significant turn when he met a vivacious and outgoing young woman named Brenda Wright at Brigham Young University in 1981. Brenda, one of five sisters herself, came from an equally close family who were also members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. A former beauty queen and broadcast journalism major, Brenda was determined to become a news anchor, an ambition she fulfilled when she began working on the university's daily news show. The couple's connection was immediate, and they fell deeply in love, marrying on Brenda's graduation weekend in 1982. The newlyweds settled in American Fork, a small town about 30 miles from Salt Lake City. A year later, they welcomed daughter Erica into the world. Brenda took a break from her budding TV career to care for their new baby, and the family of three enjoyed a peaceful life in their tight-knit community. However, trouble was brewing within the wider Lafferty family, as Alan's brothers Ron and Dan were increasingly drawn to extreme religious views. Despite the Mormon church disagreeing with polygamy, Dan believed it should be practiced. He even attempted to form a polygamous marriage with his wife Matilda and his 14-year-old stepdaughter, saying,
"I felt it was God's will, and the church just didn't understand it."
Dan's radical beliefs led to his excommunication in 1982, and he moved his family to a remote farm. Here, the family began living without modern conveniences, a fridge the only electrical appliance allowed. While Dan ruled the household, Matilda was expected to milk the cows, tend the chickens, and fetch buckets of water to bathe the children. It was a hard and lonely existence, one that was making Matilda increasingly unhappy in her marriage. Things were equally bad in Ron's household. Once in a happy and equitable marriage with his wife Diana, he'd begun experiencing extreme financial problems and almost lost the family home when he was unable to make loan repayments on it. Dan told Ron it was God's will if he lost everything and began steering him towards his more extreme views. This led to Ron's own excommunication from his church in 1983, and as he became ever more indoctrinated into Dan's way of thinking, he began subjecting Diana to escalating abuse. Soon, the brothers formed a fundamentalist sect called the School of Prophets, advocating for polygamy and male dominance. They tried to recruit their siblings, including Alan, But Brenda stood firm against their beliefs and also encouraged her sisters-in-law to resist, becoming a beacon of support for them. When Diana decided to divorce Ron, it was Brenda who helped her escape to Florida with her six children. Diana later said,
"Brenda was my rock. She gave me the strength to leave."
This defiance enraged Ron and Dan, who blamed Brenda for their marital problems. Then, in early 1984, Ron claimed to have received a divine revelation instructing him to remove Brenda and her baby daughter. Supposedly transcribing the Lord's words, he wrote,
"Thus saith the Lord unto my servants the prophets, it is my will and commandment that ye remove the following individuals in order that my work might go forward. For they have truly become obstacles in my path, and I will not allow my work to be stopped. First thy brother's wife Brenda and her baby, then Chloe Lowe and then Richard Stowe, and it is my will that they be removed in rapid succession."
Ron said the words came from God, but in reality, it was a revenge document targeting those he believed had wronged him. Chloe had supported Diana during the divorce, and Richard was the man who'd presided over Ron's excommunication. But the so-called removal revelation would set in motion a horrific act of violence that would shatter the Lafferty family and their community forever. On July the 24th, 1984, a day that will forever be etched in infamy, Ron and Dan Lafferty embarked on a mission driven by extremist beliefs and a chilling revelation. It was Pioneer Day in Utah, a day meant for celebration, but for Brenda and baby Erica, it became a day of unimaginable horror as the brothers, fueled by a twisted sense of divine command, forced their way into their duplex and enacted their bloody revenge. Outside in their car sat a pair of hitchhikers, Charles Carnes and Richard Knapp, and it was their testimony that would reveal the truth of the dreadful events that happened that day.
"From the car, we could hear the Lafferty brothers calling Brenda a bitch and a liar. Then one of them grabbed the cord of her vacuum cleaner and strangled her, before taking a knife and slitting her throat. All the time we could hear Brenda screaming, 'Don't hurt my baby, don't hurt my baby.'"
After killing Brenda, Dan went into Erica's room. Speaking from prison years later, he recounted without emotion what he had done in that nursery, saying,
"I walked into Erica's room and talked to her for a minute. I said, 'I'm not sure why I'm supposed to do this, but I guess God wants you home.' I looked away as I slit the baby's throat. I like to think she didn't suffer. It probably should draw more sympathy from me than it does. But I don't let it."
Fleeing the scene, the brothers jumped in the car and drove to the home of Chloe Lowe, ready to kill again, but thankfully she wasn't in. And when the men attempted to drive to Richard Stowe's home, they missed the road to his house. Rather than turn back, they decided to keep driving, heading out of Utah and on the run. At around 8 o'clock that evening, Alan returned home from a long day of work, but as he approached, something felt off. The door was locked, unusual for their safe, tight-knit community. Inside, the television was playing a baseball game, but the house was otherwise eerily silent. Alan called out for Brenda and Erica, but there was no response. His heart pounded as he noticed a red smear on the light switch. Following the trail, he stumbled upon a scene of unimaginable horror in the kitchen. His 24-year-old wife lay in a pool of blood, the vacuum cleaner cord still wrapped around her neck and her throat slashed. Overwhelmed with shock and grief, Alan staggered through the house, only to find his 15-month-old daughter dead in her cot, her bedding soaked in blood. Despite his devastation, Alan managed to call the police. He had no doubt who was behind the gruesome murders. The Lafferty family, once united by their faith, had been torn apart by Ron and Dan's increasingly extreme beliefs. The police arrived swiftly, and the crime scene revealed evidence of a grim struggle. Blood was smeared on the living room walls, the floor, the doors, and the curtains, telling investigators that Brenda had fought valiantly for her and her baby's lives. Alan told the police that his brothers had shared their so-called removal revelation with him, instructing them to eliminate Brenda and Erica. He never believed they would act on it, but now the horrifying reality was undeniable. Later in court, Alan testified that Ron would often express anger towards Brenda, saying she was meddling in his affairs. When Alan questioned why his baby daughter was included in the revelation, Ron blurted out,
"Because she'd just grow up to be a bitch like her mother."
Ron and Dan Lafferty evaded capture for almost a month, moving from place to place, always staying one step ahead of the law. But their run came to an end on August 17, 1984, when the FBI received a tip-off that they had been spotted over 500 miles away in Nevada. They were arrested and extradited back to Utah, where they were each charged with two counts of criminal homicide, two counts of aggravated burglary, and two counts of conspiracy to commit homicide. The brothers now faced the full weight of the law. Initially, they were to stand trial together, but after Ron attempted suicide in jail, he was ordered to spend time in a state hospital. Dan's trial went ahead first, and in January 1985, he was convicted of two counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to two life terms without the possibility of parole. The judge said,
"In my 12 years as a judge, I have never presided over a trial of such a cruel, heinous, pointless, and senseless crime as the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty. Nor have I seen an accused who had so little remorse or feeling."
4 months later, Ron faced his own trial. He was found guilty of capital murder, and as the mastermind of the grisly murder plot, was sentenced to death. His case would wind through various appeals over the years, and his competency to stand trial was often questioned. In 1986, during a retrial, he swore at the judges and wore a sign that read "Exit Only" on the back of his trousers, telling them it was to ward off evil spirits trying to invade his body. In August 2019, after more than 30 years on death row, an appeals court refused to hear Ron's case again, and it looked like he might finally be executed. He asked to be killed by firing squad, but 3 months later died of natural causes at the age of 78. Dan, now in his 70s, remains in prison. While Ron always refused to speak to the press, Dan gave interviews from behind bars and to this day shows no remorse for the killings, saying,
"It's never haunted me. It's never bothered me."
He refuses to accept he will die in prison, instead insisting that the walls of the prison will crumble around him and he'll emerge to announce the second coming. He said he takes prison life 2 weeks at a time, hoping that God will come to release him. Brenda and Erica Lafferty were laid to rest together in Twin Falls, Idaho. Their shared gravestone bears a poignant inscription from Brenda's high school yearbook that reads,
"The life spent doing good and accomplishing goals will be remembered beyond that span of life itself."
The sentencing of Ron and Dan Lafferty brought a semblance of justice to a case that shocked a community and shattered a family. But the scars left by their heinous acts will never fully heal. The memory of Brenda and Erica lives on, a testament to the enduring impact of a life spent doing good.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
Our third and final story takes us to the streets of Argentina and a young woman named Veronica Youngblood, whose life was marked by unimaginable suffering and a descent into darkness that culminated in an unthinkable act of violence. Veronica's early life in Argentina was a harrowing tale of severe poverty and extreme violence. From a young age, she was thrust into a world where survival was a daily battle, and her childhood was marred by cruelty. She was a victim of sexual abuse by several of her own family members, and this abuse left deep scars on her psyche, shaping her into a person who would do anything to survive.
"We all knew something was wrong in that house. The screams, the bruises. But no one dared to intervene."
With no other options available, Veronica began trading her body for money in her early teens. It was a desperate attempt to escape the horrors of her home life and to find some semblance of control over her own destiny. At just 16 years old, Veronica became pregnant with her first daughter, Sharon. This moment marked a turning point in her life. Despite the overwhelming odds stacked against her, she vowed to provide a better life for her child. A neighbour would say,
"She was determined. You could see it in her eyes. She wanted Sharon to have everything she never did."
Veronica's resolve to protect and nurture Sharon was unwavering. She worked tirelessly, often in dangerous environments, to ensure that her daughter had a roof over her head and food on the table. It was a relentless struggle, but one she faced with fierce determination. Veronica's determination was a testament to her resilience and strength. Despite the pain she'd endured, she remained steadfast in her commitment to provide a better future for her daughter. But as we will see, the shadows of her past would continue to haunt her. In 2007, Veronica's life took an unexpected turn. Amid the bustling streets of Buenos Aires, she met Ron Youngblood, a US Navy pilot stationed in the city. Ron was everything Veronica had dreamed of: handsome, kind, and seemingly the answer to her prayers. For a woman who had endured so much hardship, Ron represented a glimmer of hope. The two quickly fell in love, and in 2009 they decided to take a leap of faith. They flew to Las Vegas, the city of dreams, and exchanged vows in a small, intimate ceremony. Ron became a doting stepfather to Sharon, and for a while, it seemed like Veronica's life was finally on the right track.
"Ron was my savior. He gave me hope when I had none."
In 2012, their family grew with the arrival of their daughter, Brooklyn. The birth of Brooklyn brought immense joy to the couple, and for a brief period, their lives were filled with happiness. But the nature of Ron's job soon cast a shadow over their bliss. Ron's frequent deployments meant he was often away from home, leaving Veronica to care for the children alone. The strain of his absences began to take a toll on their relationship. Veronica, who had already endured so much in her life, found herself struggling with feelings of abandonment and loneliness.
"I knew what I signed up for, but it didn't make it any easier."
Despite her efforts to keep the family together, the constant relocations and long periods of separation proved too much. By 2016, the cracks in their marriage had become irreparable, and the couple decided to divorce. The divorce and subsequent custody battle over daughter Brooklyn left Veronica devastated. The man who had once been her savior was now her adversary. The glimmer of hope that Ron had brought into her life had faded, leaving behind a trail of heartbreak and despair. After their divorce in 2016, Ron Youngblood filed for sole custody of Brooklyn. What followed was a vicious custody battle that would span 2 long years. The courtroom became a battleground, with both sides slinging mud and accusations. The stakes were high and the tension was palpable. In 2018, a family court judge made a ruling that would change everything. The judge granted Ron sole custody of Brooklyn, allowing him to relocate to his hometown of Missouri with their daughter. This decision was a devastating blow to Veronica. She was left reeling, her world crumbling around her.
"I couldn't believe it. How could they take my daughter away from me? I felt like I had lost everything."
Veronica's devastation quickly turned into something far more dangerous. Consumed by thoughts of revenge against her ex-husband, she began to spiral out of control. Her mind was a storm of anger and despair, and she could think of nothing else but making Ron pay for what she saw as an unforgivable betrayal. Veronica's downward spiral was swift and terrifying. She became obsessed with the idea of revenge, her thoughts dark and twisted. She could see no way out of her pain, no way to reclaim the life she had lost. And so she began to plot.
"I couldn't let him take her. I just couldn't. I had to do something."
On July the 27th, 2018, Veronica took a step that would seal her fate when she purchased a handgun. For 9 long days, she plotted an unthinkable act of betrayal and tragedy. Her mind was set. Her course unchangeable. Veronica's thoughts of revenge had been festering for a long time. But now they had taken on a life of their own. She was consumed by them, driven by a dark and dangerous determination. The custody battle had been lost, but the real battle was just beginning. A battle that would end in unimaginable tragedy.
I felt like I had no other choice. I had to take control.
On the night of August the 5th, Veronica reached her breaking point. Her life, once filled with dreams and hopes, had crumbled into a nightmare. And on this fateful night, she committed an act that would leave an indelible mark on all it touched, her daughters Brooklyn and Sharon, the innocent victims. As the evening settled in, Veronica handed the girls gummies laced with sleeping pills. The children, unaware of their mother's sinister intentions, consumed the treats and soon fell into a deep, drug-induced slumber. With her daughters unconscious, Veronica picked up the handgun she had purchased just days earlier. The first shot was fired at Brooklyn, striking her once in the head. The 5-year-old died instantly. Veronica then turned to 15-year-old Sharon, her eldest daughter. Veronica shot her twice, once in the chest and once in the back. Despite her grievous injuries, Sharon managed to summon the strength to call 911. Her voice, weak and filled with pain, conveyed the horror of what had just transpired.
911, what's your emergency?
My mom. She shot me. I don't want to die.
The call was a desperate plea for help, but it was too late. Sharon's injuries were too severe. She was rushed to the hospital, but despite the best efforts of the medical team, she succumbed to her wounds 3 days later. In the aftermath of the shootings, Veronica left a chilling voicemail for her ex-husband, Ron.
I killed them, Ron. I killed the children you love so much. I hate you.
The voicemail was a final act of cruelty, a twisted declaration of her vengeance. Veronica's actions on that night were driven by a toxic mix of anger, despair, and a desire for control. The lives of Brooklyn and Sharon were tragically cut short, leaving a void that could never be filled. Veronica Youngblood fled the scene, but the next day, on August the 6th, the search for her came to a swift conclusion in Loudoun County. An acquaintance, startled by a knock on their front door, found Veronica standing there, dishevelled and holding the murder weapon. They called police and Veronica didn't resist when she was taken into custody. In the interrogation room, Veronica confessed to the killings. Her voice was steady, almost detached, as she recounted the events of that tragic night. She told investigators that she felt she deserved the death penalty for what she'd done. But despite her initial confession, Veronica's defense took a dramatic turn as her trial date approached. She pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, claiming that voices had commanded her to kill her daughters.
Ms. Youngblood has a history of severe mental illness. She heard voices that told her to commit these acts.
The prosecution, however, painted a different picture. They described Veronica as manipulative and calculated, driven by a vengeful desire to hurt her ex-husband.
This person wants to manipulate, this person wants to lie, ensue chaos, all for this person's personal gain. Ms. Youngblood is spiteful, selfish, vengeful, and calculated.
The trial, which began in March 2023, was a battleground of conflicting narratives. Veronica's defense team argued that her traumatic past and mental health issues had driven her to commit the unthinkable. The prosecution, on the other hand, insisted that this was a cold-blooded act of revenge. Veronica herself told the court her ex-husband was to blame for the murders. From the witness box, she shouted to her former spouse and grieving father, Ron,
"Why did you leave me? Why did you leave me alone with the girls? None of this would have happened."
In the end, the jury was not swayed by the insanity plea. After just a day of deliberation, they found Veronica Youngblood guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder and 2 counts of felony firearm use. She was sentenced to at least 78 years behind bars, the judge would say.
This case goes well beyond merely having a mental illness. This goes well beyond depression. This goes well beyond PTSD. This goes well beyond being suicidal.
As the sentence was read out, Veronica screamed and had to be physically restrained as the courtroom was cleared. The aftermath of her actions left a community in mourning and a family shattered beyond repair. In the wake of the sentencing, the prosecuting attorney read a heartfelt statement saying,
Sharon and Brooklyn are two children that should be alive today. This case is a terrible tragedy, and I hope today's verdict brings a measure of healing for the family.
The story of Veronica Youngblood was undoubtedly a tragedy from start to finish. But while she deserves some empathy, our greatest sympathies must lie with those left to cope with the devastating loss of two beautiful young children. That's all from this week's episode. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time when we'll be bringing you three more tales of true life terror. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.